Ghoulish greetings, everybody. Thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your morning, day, night, whenever you listen and wherever you listen from. It is greatly appreciated. I'm, of course, your host, Tessa Morrow, and this week's special city shoutouts go to Tainan City, Taiwan, Windhoek, Namibia, Parsippany, New Jersey, Glostrup Municipality, Denmark, Middletown, Ohio, and Vacaville, California. So today I continue on the World War II adventure from my grandpa's own words. And this journal entry has to be probably one of my favorites. Kind of just talks about everyday life, being displaced and going somewhere else, adding a little possible romance, and a horrifying story that was shared with him that you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. Let's dive right in. It's hard to believe that after all these years, after all the hardships, after all the plodding through the snow, the rain, the ice, the sand, the mud, the sprays from the waters of the English Channel, the Atlantic, the Mediterranean, the sweating out the Heine bullets, their 88s, their rockets, their dive bombers, watching close buddies getting knocked off, losing some because they got transferred out because they finally couldn't take anymore and went berserk. Yes, really hard to believe that this goddamn war is finally over. Now, in the great world chess game, what is the next move for us little pawns that are left on the board? Maybe next, though remote, Tokyo. Can it be that soon, for Christ's sake, we can give up this life of living like animals and get out of this nightmare called an army? Unfortunately, that little dream did not come to pass for many months hence. As usual, everything around us was very chaotic and all screwed up. Suddenly, it was all quiet on the Western Front. The shooting stopped, and now it was time to rearrange the chaos. Our battalion was ensconced in an area some 100 miles from Pilsen, Czechoslovakia, where we linked up with Russian troops coming in from the east. The Russian troops indeed. To encounter the individual Russian soldier is an experience in itself. They were even grimier looking than we nondescript sad sacks. Their clothes were bedraggled and worn, and like us, I'm sure their skins did not feel warm bathwater for many, many months. Their source of supply must have included a pretty generous portion of vodka, because these guys were what you would call elatedly sauced. Naturally, it's understandable why they were emotionally high. They were almost out of control. True, though, we all know that earlier in the war, things looked very bleak for Russia. The German Wehrmacht was right on their doorstep on the outskirts of Moscow. They suffered thousands of casualties and were there, almost administered the coup de grace. Anyhow, we jumped around with the Russians, shaking hands, embracing each other. I felt embarrassed when their greetings included big smelly kisses on the cheeks. And I was surprised to notice that there was a sprinkling of female soldiers with their frontline troops. They were big and burly, and they were acting just as crazy as their male comrades. Their clothes were dirty and ragged. One of them gave me a big bear hug and a kiss, and promptly stepped aside a few feet, squatted down, and relieved herself. As the French say, c'est une guerre. After the greetings and celebrations subsided, the main elements of the battalion moves back west some 15 miles and set up the battalion post, better known as the CP. About where we met up with the Russians, a perimeter line was set up with the U.S. troops patrolling one side, Russian troops patrolling the other. On the U.S. side, Sections consisting of 12 men were dispersed 10 miles apart along the whole line. Since I was the ranking NCO in our section, I was placed in charge of our 12 men. We had it very nice because we were placed in an area on the shores of a small lake in a very beautiful high mountain country. About a quarter of a mile across from us, on the other side of the lake, a contingent of Russian troops set up to guard that part of the line. Even though the shooting was over, we, as a force of habit, dug foxholes in the area close to where we laid down our bedrolls, and we prepared to spend what we thought would be our first peaceful night for a long time. We hadn't received mail for a long time, so I went with a couple of the boys back to the CP to pick up our mail and also some rations. Speaking of rations, the forest situation in the entire U.S. zone was at a very low ebb. Thousands of prisoners of war and thousands of displaced civilians had to be fed, and this thankless task fell on the shoulders of the United States Army. We were living strictly on sea rations and or whatever we could scrounge from the countryside, like an occasional pheasant or a goose or fish out of the lakes and streams that we happened upon. In our section, we were fortunate because we had two champion chow hounds in Crocker and Super Buyer. All through the war, I don't care where we were, these two guys, always snooping around, came back with eggs or onions, figs, dates in Africa and Sicily, maybe a goose, maybe some trout, maybe even a deer or an antelope, but always something. They also had a thing with the mess sergeant, talking him out of a lot more rations than we had coming. Many of the rations that we got from the mess sergeant were used to trade to civilians for vegetables, eggs, chickens, or whatnot. Thank God for those two guys. I think that our little section was the best fed section in the entire army. I always advocated that a soldier can fight a lot better with a belly full of good food. While we were digging our foxholes, Zuby and Crocker went up the mountain a ways to a stream that seemed to be pretty well stocked with trout. They came back with a bunch of 14-inchers and in no time had them sizzling on the fire. We had a very nice little repast consisting of trout, beans, and hash, topped off by 2 liters of vodka that Zuby traded from the Russians for 3 packs of Camels. We sat around by the fire after we ate, enjoying the very strong vodka and reflecting on our good fortune in as much as our war was finally over, and that we were lucky enough to be halfway sane and still active layers on the big chessboard. It was dusk. We hadn't had much sleep lately, and some of the boys were already in their fart sacks, bedrolls. It felt good that finally we were going to get a good quiet night's sleep. A full moon was just coming up over the water. The crickets were chirping, and the frogs down by the lake, well, they were croaking. It gave a guy a feeling of elation just to be laying there, looking up at the stars and thinking that soon we will be home. I drifted off to sleep. Suddenly, in the quiet of the night, a rapid burst of shots emanated from across the lake. I was frightened, but then I thought, oh, it's the Russians. They're celebrating and probably just firing salvos from their rifles. That was not the reason, though. It seems that one of them, very drunk, of course, wandered away from the area. And as he stumbled back, another Russian, equally as drunk, thinking he was a German straggler, shot him in the stomach. There was chaos across the lake. The Russians were chattering like monkeys. We still thought they were just celebrating, but soon into our area came a wagon drawn by 2 galloping horses. There were 6 Russians in it, and they were still chattering like monkeys. Our guard, who was on sentry duty, stopped the wagon and called me over to see what was going on. I certainly could not understand their chattering, but by their gestures, I determined that they wanted me to look in the wagon. I shined my flashlight in, and there on the floor of the wagon was a young soldier, writhing painfully with a gunshot wound in his abdomen. I knew he was very seriously injured because he was bleeding profusely. I told Zuby to get on the radio and call the CP. While he was doing that, I spread sulfur on the wound, applied a lot of gauze, hoping to stem the flow of blood. Zuby had Colonel Bennett on the phone at the CP. He advised me to get the man to the CP as fast as we could. He said that he would have Captain Smith, the Bird Battalion medical officer, ready to tend to him. We secured the man on a stretcher, and with a Russian lieutenant and one of our men, Crocker took off in his jeep toward the CP. When they arrived there, Smitty did everything he could with what he had to save the boy, but after an hour, he died. What irony to suffer through all the hardships of the war, emerging unscathed, and then to get knocked off in a drunken orgy by one of his own comrades. Yep, pretty damn ironical. There comes a time in a young soldier's life when his thoughts turn from the routine rigors of fighting a war into a much more beautiful diversion. The rigors of sweating out someone of the opposite sex with whom, perhaps, a dalliance of some sort could be manifest. And indeed, a dalliance with an extremely beautiful girl would manifest. And it was one which resulted in a love affair that, brief as it was most beautiful and exciting. The days crept by. The boys in my section and I remained ensconced across the lake from where the Russians were. Nothing much had happened since that night of the tragedy across the lake. The days were very boring. There was nothing for us to do except sit around and daydream about the time when someone would come up to us and say, "Hey, look alive. You guys are going home." Our idleness gave us an opportunity to wash and mend our clothes, which we hadn't been able to do for a long time. We had an ample supply of gasoline, so we dry cleaned our clothes. We just filled up a can with the gas, soaked the clothes, and hung them out to dry. So now our clothes were nice and clean. We shaved off our beards and mustaches, but alas, we had no place to go. As I mentioned before, due to the situation confronting the army because of the POWs and displaced persons that had to be fed, the food that we were getting from the battalion was still nothing but, beans, hash, and spam. I swore that if I ever got out of the army, I would never look another bean in the eye again. But as long as we had the two chow hounds, Zuby and Crocker, we weren't too concerned about the slop they were sending us from the battalion, most of which we got. We put in escrow and saved it for future trade bait. Needless to say, we were very happy to get the coffee, sugar, powdered milk, and cigarettes that were available to us from the mess sergeant. But what were we eating? We were eating like the proverbial king. Much wild game abounded in this area. Not a day went by that we didn't have pheasant, goose, wild turkey, deer, quail, and many other types of birds or animals, and of course, the fine trout for our dining room table. Wouldn't you know it, the top brass in our unit found out how good we were eating, so, what seemed like 2 seconds flat, out came a directive stating that there would be no hunting or fishing in our area. Captain Parham, who brought the directive up to us, also said, "There are many people passing through this area, many of whom are German. Let me remind you that stiff punishment will be invoked on anyone caught fraternizing with German women. You guys stay clean. You don't want anything serious to happen that might impede your chances of getting home as soon as possible. And again, remember, absolutely no hunting." And I said, "Well, thank you, Captain. I'll make sure that the boys eat beans tonight." The captain didn't know that at that very minute, Zuby was nearby in the woods dressing a young white-tailed buck that he had brought down that morning. Orders in the army are made to be followed. Ridiculous orders are made to be broken. These particular orders we deemed ridiculous, so we cautiously proceeded to feed our bellies with whatever morsel happened to come our way. A week later, orders came over the radio that we were to march order our equipment and report back to the battalion. I thought, oh Christ, unless we are going to be shipped home, I certainly hate the idea of leaving this veritable Garden of Eden, because the past 2 weeks have been the best days that we have seen since we came overseas 3 years ago. I went to Captain Parham's office, and this is what I was told. We are moving your section to an area on the outskirts of a small town called Roki County. There is a large compound there set up for displaced persons, most of whom are German civilians. It is approximately 1 square mile, and it is enclosed by a high barbed wire fence. Guards from the Czech army are posted at all 3 gates, and unauthorized people are not allowed in or out. There are many Russian soldiers in the area, and even though the compound is off limits to them, groups of them are either bribing the guards or just pushing past them and drunkenly going in and creating holy hell. The people there are mostly women, children, and elderly. There are 3 large barn-like structures where these people are living. The Russians wait till dark, then they go in, mostly in search of women, who they won't hesitate to rape. After they get in the barns, the people really let it out. You can hear their yells and screams all over town. The citizens of the town resent having the compound in their town in the first place, and they are complaining about the noise coming from there at night. It will be your job to bring peace and serenity to this little area. I picked out your section because you have a fair command of German and French, and I think you and your boys will do a good job. By the way, you will remind your boys that there will be no hanky-panky with the German women in the compound. The Czech lieutenant, who speaks German and a little English, will be here at 2 this afternoon to lead you to the camp and show you around when you get there. It's about 20 miles from here. You will have telephone communications with us at all times, day and night. You will have a half-track and 3 jeeps. Mail and rations will be sent to you once a week. At 3 in the afternoon, we pulled into the camp at Roki County. It's difficult for me to describe this hastily constructed United States displaced persons compound. At the end of the war, there were thousands of people wandering loose with really no place to go. Many of them had been driven from their homes due to the ravaging battles that enveloped their towns. Many had gone from area to area wherever the war dictated they should or could go. The Allies found it necessary to establish DP camps to feed and nourish these civilians till they could be relocated. At this particular camp, 90% of the inmates were German civilians from the Sudetenland, which, of course, before the treaties of World War I, was a part of Germany. There were no young men there. The young men were either in the military or they were prisoners of war in some far-off area. So the people were, as I mentioned before, women, young and old, children, and old men. The people were cramped into 3 large barns in which there was no rooms or divided sections. Families or small groups hung up sheets and blankets as their separating walls. The people got their water from 2 taps hooked up in each barn. Each barn had a makeshift kitchen where the people lined up in shifts to get the soup and food that was made available to them. Needless to say, the food supply was short, albeit sufficient. There was no toilet facilities. Some 200 yards behind each barn, long, narrow ditches about 15 feet were dug. Large telephone-like poles are arranged over the holes, and those who had to have bowel movements, or women who had to urinate, sat on the poles and let it drop. Chemical mixtures of lye and whatnot was dropped into the holes each day to alleviate the possibility of disease spreading because of the unsanitary conditions. Out in front of the barn, some 200 yards away, a small river ran right through the compound. It was very handy because it afforded the people areas to wash their clothing and themselves. Near the front entrance of the compound, there was a small fenced-in area that was off-limits. Before the war, this particular area was used as a public swimming pool. It had a small 3-room structure and about 25 small locker rooms that the swimmers used to change their clothes in. I set up my office in the small structure. Thank God it had a room with a toilet and a shower in it. I was grateful to know that I was not going to have to use the pole over the long hole. But what the heck? Using the pole would be better than what we use most of the time for the last 3 years. What we had was a secluded place, a shovel, and a roll of paper. I walked around the compound with the Czech officer. I appeared to be quite an attraction to the throngs of people milling about in the camp. Supposedly, I was the first American that many of them had seen. I was the recipient of a lot of curious glances and, to my delight, several flirtatious smiles from some of the German girls, many of whom were very attractive. I thought to myself, this could turn out to be a very interesting assignment, the non-fraternization rule notwithstanding. I got back to where the boys in the section were lolling in the shade by the river. I clued them in as what our duties were expected to be. I stressed the fact that no one was to be allowed in the compound, especially Russian soldiers, and I said, "Okay, you horny bastards, this place is full of German girls, and you know the policy is that fraternization with them is strictly a no-no." Fraternization is a big, long word. I'm not so sure that I know the full meaning of it. I expect that you guys, given the opportunity, will mingle a little bit with the girls. I expect that I might also, if given the opportunity. Let's be very discreet about it. You can't screw up. So far, what I've noticed, the girls seem to be very congenial and probably will be very happy to consort with you rich American soldiers whose coffers are overloaded with cigarettes, coffee, soup, chocolate candy, and yes, ham, beans, and spam. For sure, let's not force ourselves, obviously, on any who are not agreeable. Don't forget that these people are trigger happy because there have been several rapes committed. Let's not forget that the reason we are here are to prevent the panicky outbursts and screaming that can be heard for miles away. I'm going to leave it up to you guys to use your best judgment. I rather think that even though we are going to be denied the beautiful source of food that we enjoyed the last few weeks, our stay in this area could turn out to be most pleasant. Again, no screw-ups, or we will be out of here quicker than we got here. And I told the guys to pick them out a locker, lay their bed rolls down, and call the little room their home for as long as we are here. I planned on laying my bed roll down in my office. We appeared to be the major attraction of the camps as we sat around talking. The people, most of whom were girls, milled around, looking at us as though we were sideshow freaks. We tried to maintain a friendly attitude, but we avoided getting too close to them. The girls knew that we were loaded with goodies, the likes of which they hadn't seen for a very long time, and it was obvious that they were more than willing to form friendships. I had my field glasses out, and we were sitting there talking, and I scanned the area around the compound. I noticed a girl down by the river, sitting on the bank, washing her legs. Soon I became divorced from the present company, and became completely engrossed in what I saw down by the river. Some of the girls were getting pretty friendly, but unlike the other guys who were in the process of making points, I got up and I said I was going to take a little stroll. I walked down by the river where the girl was undergoing her ablutions. I timed myself to arrive just as she was in the process of drying her hair and getting ready to leave. The closer I got to her, the more beautiful she appeared. My hopes and expectations reached a boiling point. I thought, my God, how beautiful she is. That's the girl for me. She was wrapping a scarf around her hair when I approached her. I said, Guten Tag, ich bin Gerald. And I offered her a Hershey's bar. After noticing the friendly girls all afternoon, I figured that this young girl would be real happy to make my acquaintance and to relish my chocolate bar and my cigarettes. She turned her head and looked at me with venom in her big blue eyes, with a sneer on her face, and without a word, she turned and walked away. Like most young guys with a big, big ego, I was really flabbergasted. I wasn't used to getting my door slammed that way. I headed back to where my boys were. The more I thought about her cruel evasiveness, the more I wanted her. And the less I was interested in making it with, apparently, many more available girls. I got back to my office and I noticed that all the boys were pretty well paired off, and I thought, how ironical. After all these months of celibacy, these guys all have a girl. And I will spend the night by myself in my fart sack, thinking about the young beauty down by the river. The first night in the compound was quiet without incident. I spent a restless, discouraging night tossing around in my new quarters. The boys in the section discreetly partied all night. The next day, I was getting very bored hanging around the guys. because all they could talk about was their conquest of the night before. And I got sick listening to them, so I took off by myself and took a stroll around the compound, hoping that I might see the girl who, before, was so aloof. Rumors and talk, they travel fast around an area where so many people are confined. The big news that was going around was that the American soldiers were here and that they were very generous with items that, around the compound, were non-existent. Consequently, we were very popular. As I walked around, people that I encountered tried to get me into conversation. And when they found out that I spoke German, it was more difficult for me to shy away from them. I never had so many inviting smiles from so many pretty girls. And if I hadn't been so enraptured with the girl down by the river, I could have made some interesting acquaintances. I strained my neck looking for this girl, but alas, no luck. I was hoping that I could find her, win her over, and not have to spend another night alone. I made myself a pair of swimming trunks by cutting a pair of fatigues, and that evening, I went down by the river for a good swim. The water was so good, and after a while, I sat down on the bank, and I lit a cigarette. I looked up, and lo and behold, the mystery girl came walking by with another girl. I felt so elated, I jumped up, ran over to them, said hello, and I offered them both a cigarette. This girl gave me a cold look, just as she did the evening before, and with an accent, but the surprising good English, she said, "No, thank you. I don't want anything from you. Please don't bother me." And she walks away. Her friend, who was also very attractive, came up to me and said, "My name is Lisbeth. I want to apologize for my friend for being so rude to you. She is very bitter and talks to hardly anyone in the compound but me." She took the cigarette that I offered her and indicated by her smile that she would like to be a friend of mine. She said that her friend's name was Rosemary, and I told her that I was really stricken with Rosemary and asked her to tell her that I was so sorry for having bothered her. I gave her the rest of the cigarettes in my pack, turned, and I went back to my quarters. As I was getting into my bedroll that night, I murmured to myself, "Thank you very much, another lonely night by myself." Everything was quiet and serene. I had been asleep for a couple of hours, when about midnight, all hell broke loose. Much screaming and hollering was coming from one of the barns. I dressed, got my automatic, and my flashlight. I ran over to the barn. Two Russian soldiers had gone in and were creating havoc. Women were screaming, babies and children were crying, and old men were arguing and trying to restrain them. I turned on the lights, located the Russians, and with my gun at their backs, escorted them out of the barn and compound. At first I thought they were going to give me trouble, but they meekly walked out with me. I couldn't believe it, but the next day, as I walked around the compound, people mobbed me as though I was a big hero. Old ladies came up and kissed me. Old men shook my hands, and I really felt embarrassed. The guys in the section teased me, saying I should get the Congressional Medal. I told them that if they hadn't been so busy with their girlfriends, I might have had a little bit of help. That evening, I went swimming again, and after, when I was sitting on the bank smoking my cigarette, to my utter surprise, up walked Rosemary. This time, she had a smile on her face. I was speechless. After her cold attitude the 2 days before, I'd sort of given up on her. She was more beautiful than when I first saw her through the filled glasses. She was tall, about 5'8". Her hair, it was coal black, and her eyes, were deep blue. She had a high, prominent cheekbones and sensuous, beautiful lips. Her strong, even teeth were outstanding, especially when she smiled. Wondering why she accosted me, I stood up and lit another Camel from the one that I was already smoking. She said, "My name is Rosemary Zimmer. My friend Lisbeth told me that you are Gerald. I want to apologize for being so rude to you. I was in the barn last night when you drove those Russians out. They already had a hold of me. I admire what you did, and I am very sorry I acted the way I did. Please forgive me." And I said, "It was nothing. I just did what we came here to do." Then I told her how much I really admired her and that obviously ever since I saw her, I was eager to meet her and be her friend. She smiled and said, "From what I have heard and noticed, you Americans have met many girls and seem to be well enough occupied that you would notice the likes of me. I'm not so sure that I could be like those girls and do what they are doing for the food, soap, and cigarettes that they are getting." And I said, "Well, maybe what they are doing is not right. But considering what we, you, and everyone have been through the last few years, I'm not going to say what is right or what is wrong. People will do what they do. I just hope they are happy doing it, because Lord knows there have been enough trials and tribulations and sadness. But anyhow, Rosemarie, I am happy that I have met you. And if those two drunken soldiers are responsible for this, I would like to give them a smelly kiss on the cheeks." She sat with me on the bank, and we talked and talked. It was clouding up, and it was almost time for supper. I asked her if I could cook a meal for her. She said that would be good, but she couldn't see me until 7:30, because she promised her neighbor, an elderly woman who was ill, that she would get in the food line for her and bring her a meal. She said that she would meet me by the bridge that crossed the river at 7:30. I was so thrilled that I went back to my quarters on a high cloud talking to myself. I took a shower, put on some clean clothes, and straightened up my room. I couldn't wait for the time to come when I was to meet Rosemarie under the bridge. At 7:15, still on a cloud, I headed for the little bridge. It started sprinkling, and it appeared as though we were going to be in for a pretty good storm. By the time I got to the bridge, the rain was pounding down with a vengeance. I crawled under the bridge to try to keep dry, but water was blowing in from the sides and leaking through the cracks. Soon I was soaked, and I began thinking, "Now Rosemarie probably will not show up, and I won't blame her if she doesn't. Why do I have to be so goddamn unlucky? It seems that it is destined that I am not to be with her." I lit my Zippo, looked at my watch. It was 7:35, and no Rosemarie. Suddenly, through the mist, I looked up, and a hunched-up figure was walking through the torrent toward me. Thank God it was her! I got up from under the bridge and said, "Come on, honey, let's go somewhere where it's warm." And we ran through the rain to my quarters. When we got there, we were shivering, and we were soaked to the skin. I gave Rosemarie a towel and a pair of my dry fatigues, and she put them on while I was making a little fire in my pot-bellied stove. I put on some dry clothes, and soon the room was nice and warm. I fixed up, which surprisingly was a pretty good hot meal. I warmed up venison roast that Zuby had cooked up a few days before, and heated some beans and hash. Rosemarie ate as though she were famished. It did my heart good to just sit back and watch her relish this simple little meal that I had concocted for her. She couldn't get over how good the American coffee tasted. For a couple of months, I had been hoarding a bottle of cognac that I picked up as we were advancing across France, and I thought that this was a very appropriate time to pop the cork. After we ate, we turned the light out, lit a candle, and sat on my bedroll. And we began plying each other with question after question, and it was still raining cats and dogs outside. The roof of my little abode was leaking in about half a dozen spots, but I could care less. I was baking in my happiness and felt like I was in paradise. Since not being around a woman for so many months, I was truly surprised how docile and mild I was with Rosemarie as we sat warming up by the fire, drinking our cognac, and smoking our camels. I did refer to the guys in the section as a bunch of horny bastards, and of course I certainly was one also, but I had no desire to ravage this beautiful creature sitting beside me. I asked Rosemarie question after question about her 22 years on this earth. I soon found out and could certainly understand why she was so bitter. She was the daughter of a very affluent family who resided in Leipzig, Germany. Her dad was one of the most prominent surgeons in the city and was chief of staff of Leipzig's University Hospital. Rosemarie, before the war, was in her third year at the University of Leipzig. in quest of a medical degree. She lived with her mom and dad and two twin sisters in a large, beautiful home near the campus. Her two sisters, 2 years her junior, were also enrolled in the university. Shortly after the Nazis occupied France, the Zimmer family in Leipzig encountered horrible, tragic events. Dr. Zimmer was strictly pro-democratic and was known to be dead against everything that the Nazi Party advocated. A known enemy of his, a doctor under him at the hospital, became a member of the dreaded Gestapo stationed in Leipzig. The utmost project in this man's mind was to finger Dr. Zimmer and make the Gestapo aware that he was an avowed enemy of Hitler and the Third Reich. For several months, Dr. Zimmer's stature in the city made him more or less untouchable in the scrutiny of the Gestapo. But the constant prodding of his envious foe prevailed, and the Gestapo, convinced that he was an enemy of the state, decided to investigate him, along with thousands of other German civilians who balked against the new German government. Rosemarie was on a 5-day holiday in Paris. Her twin sisters and her mother and dad were sitting down enjoying a well-prepared dinner when a group of stormtroopers accompanied by Dr. Zimmer's friend turned enemy entered their home and was in the process of placing Dr. Zimmer under arrest. Dr. Zimmer, seeing his associate as one of his arresting officers, went into a rage, got a gun out of his desk, and attempted to shoot him. He had no chance. Before he could raise the gun, he was riddled with machine gun fire. His wife, attempting to intervene, was caught in the fire, and she was also killed. The twins were taken into custody. After this horrendous happening, Rosemarie's uncle, her father's brother, cautiously sneaked into Paris, went to the relative's house where Rosemarie was staying, and related the tragedy that befell her family. She was shocked and grief-stricken. Suddenly, her beautiful existence had turned into a hellish nightmare. She lost her parents, her home, and she knew that the chances of ever seeing her young sisters were very remote. Her uncle was a prosperous businessman in Leipzig. He was also anti-Nazi and realized that he too was a marked man. He and Rosemarie conferred and decided that they should not go back to Leipzig, and now that the German army had overran Paris, they would have to go into hiding, which they did. Subsequently, they joined the French underground and spent the entire war in hiding, most of the time living in squalor, mid many privations. Shortly before the end of the war, Rosemarie and her uncle, they were arrested. They were taken out of Paris to an area just outside of Bonn, Germany, there to await certain execution. Speaking of misery and squalor, the prison camp was absolutely dreadful. It was more than the mind could conjure. The prisoners here were destined only for death. They were treated like animals, getting tasteless, watery soup twice a day for their food rations. After 6 days, Rosemarie's uncle was mercifully executed. She was taken into Bonn, where she was scheduled to be doing work in a medical laboratory. This lab was used to conduct grisly experiments on human bodies, and even though they told her that she would be working there as a cleaning woman, she suspected that she was going to be used as part of their experiments. As she was cleaning one of the rooms one day, she gasped in horror as she saw three headless young female bodies floating in a brine tank. She thought, "My God, I know that I will end up in that tank." Before she was put into the tank for headless young girls, the war was over. Now, supposedly, she was free. She was penniless, emaciated health-wise, hungry, and she had no place to go. She was caught up in the confusion and chaos of the post-war and finally ended up in the displaced persons compound in Rokycany, Czechoslovakia. Little wonder that she was bitter, lost her home, lost her family. lived like a rat, cold and hungry all through the war, almost executed, and now she was living like an animal in a compound where she had to sit on a log and shit down a ditch in the ground. I told you this journal entry would be intense. And I mean, my heart breaks for Rose Marie. Mother and father murdered. Who knows if she was ever reunited with her sisters and if her twin sisters even survived. And then her uncle executed as well. And then seeing those headless girls. I just can't even imagine. And that's just one person's story. There were thousands upon thousands of displaced people in these encampments. And each one of these people had a story. And I remember when I first read these words that my grandpa wrote and talking about Rose Marie's life. Like he said, it's no wonder that this poor girl was bitter. I hope that she eventually got to live a long and happy life. And hopefully she did get to see her sisters again. Again, you have just heard a true account from World War II from my grandfather, Gerald Morrow. Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They are all phenomenal. Haven't heard every single damn one yet? No need to worry. No need to fret. Don't lose sleep over it. Hit up any of those amazing podcast platforms, such as Pocket Cast, Podcast Republic, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, CastBox. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Prowlers Podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everyone, and I will see you
next week.